How are you this morning? Quiet. Wow, everybody's quiet. Good. Well, you have to forgive me a little bit. I got a touch of rigor mortis this morning. It's all right. We'll get through this. We're going to start. We finished up the book of Romans, so we're going to start a new book study. Nobody else stepped forward, so we're going to turn to the book of Exodus. And right off the bat, I'd like to read Exodus chapter 1. We'll have a word of prayer, and then we'll get to talking about why we decided to go to Exodus here. So if you don't mind, Exodus chapter 1, start at verse 1, we'll read the whole chapter. It says, "Now these are the names of the children of Israel, which came into Egypt. Every man in his household came with him, or came with Jacob. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin. Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher, and all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. And there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also up into our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar and in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other Puah. And he said, When you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then you shall kill him. And if it be a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwife feared God, and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, Why have you done this thing and have saved the men children alive? And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively and are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. And Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, Every son that is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. Let's have a word of prayer this morning. Lord, we do thank you for this day. It's a beautiful day. Calm, still, sun shining. Beautiful, beautiful day. We thank you for it. We thank you for your word. We thank you for this time to gather in your house. We thank you that it's kind of cool in here. It's nice. These little blessings. We do ask that you'll keep your hand upon Marion as she's going to see her son. We ask that things will go well there. And that there will be comfort. And that there will be a blessing. Make yourself known to both of them. It's in your name I pray. Amen. Now, we've already read this passage, so I'm going to do something a little different than how I usually do it. I'm not going to pick each verse apart like I have done. We're going to try and take a broad view here. And we can see right off the bat, as we read this chapter in the book of Exodus, that it's never meant to be a standalone book. You can see that right off the bat. We pick right up verse 1 with the story of a family we're expected to already know. It says, Now these are the names of the children. Well, who's Israel? Who's his children? Who are these people? We already expected to know about Joseph. Who is this Joseph guy? We're told that they moved to Egypt. We're never told where they moved from. So obviously, with such ambiguous nature of the first few verses of the first chapter of Exodus, you're supposed to know that there's a prequel, right? We also learn in verse 5 that one member of the family, Joseph, he's already in Egypt already. He's already there. Moses just assumes that you've already read Genesis. He assumes you've already read Genesis. And that's part of why I think it's a good time to go to Exodus. Brother Fisher just worked his way through Genesis. I got a few personal reasons. I've been a little ways away from the Old Testament. I kind of got a hankering to get back in it. Tell you the truth, my Hebrew's gotten a little bit rusty, so I'd like to get back into using it a little bit more often. Now, as you recall from Genesis, Genesis kind of left us hanging, didn't it? I mean, we're left with Jacob. He blesses all Israel, blesses all the children, and we're kind of left there. So these two books, Genesis and Exodus, need to be seen together, probably more so than any other of the books of Moses. They're like part one and part two. Now, in Genesis, we saw a running theme. We saw a sequence of things that happened. We saw distrust, disbelief, and disobedience over and over and over again, right? It started in Genesis 3. The first human beings that are on this earth, God creates human beings. What's the first thing they do? They start to distrust him, they disbelieve him, and then they disobey him. Genesis chapter 3. And we saw it throughout the book of Genesis. All of God's people seem to have this cycle that they went through. By the way, it still goes on today. We also saw the opposite in the book of Genesis. We saw two things happening. We saw the distrust to disobedience cycle, but we also saw a sequence of belief and obedience. Belief and obedience. For you believe God, then you will obey God. You disbelieve God, you will disobey God. We saw in Genesis chapter 12, Genesis chapter 15, Genesis chapter 22, that's when particularly good one, when Abraham takes Isaac up onto the mountain, right? He believed God, he obeyed God. Simple. The stories of Jacob and Joseph were full of growing belief and obedience. A little more belief, a little more obedience. A little more belief, a little more obedience. Till they finally... God changed Jacob's name to Israel. And that's why we're now referring to Jacob's sons as the children of Israel. All of this trust in Genesis was based on one thing. One thing led to this trust in the book of Genesis, and that is the promises of God. That's the promises of God. That's what Exodus is all about, is God keeps his promises. There are other things that happen, but God keeps his promises. But, you see, by the end of the book of Genesis, I mean, God's made all kinds of promises. Way back in Genesis 3, God makes a promise. The seed of the woman is going to crush Satan. And on through, God makes promises to Abraham, makes promises to Jacob, makes promises to Joseph. You get to the end of the book of Genesis, almost all those promises are left unfulfilled, aren't they? You're left hanging. Oh, I promise you're going to be populous. You're going to be like the sand on the seashore. You're going to be like the stars in the sky. You're going to have a land. You're going to be blessed. All the nations of the world are going to be blessed through you. At the end of Genesis, there's 70 people living in squalor in Egypt, and they've sold everything that they have to the Pharaoh. Well, that's not prosper and blessing, is it? So you're left hanging at the end of Genesis. What in the world is going on? God, where are your promises? Well, that's where Exodus comes in. You see, God never intended his promises. God makes these grand promises, huge promises, unbelievable promises, and he never expected them to be enjoyed by just a few patriarchs, a handful of 12 guys. He never expected those 12 sons of Jacob to be the only ones to receive his promises. Even their extended families, the 70 people that went down into Egypt, God wanted his promises to go to more than that. In fact, God wanted a huge group of people to enjoy them. In fact, he wanted the whole world to enjoy his promises. But now I'm jumping the gun a little bit. You see, the opposite was seen when the curse was shown, basically Genesis chapter 4 to Genesis chapter 11, Tower of Babel. The curse was seen as extending to the whole world, right? The curse started back in Eden. God cursed the ground for man's sake, cursed everything else, cursed the serpent, and the curse extended right up, we saw right up till basically the Tower of Babel. So if God's made promises, it stands to reason that they should be enjoyed by more than just Jacob and his immediate family too. If the curse extended to all mankind, then it makes sense that the promises extend to all mankind too. It's just logic. After all, God said in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 and 3, that he wanted to bless all the families of the earth through Abraham. Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3. In fact, let's read that right now, as it'll give us background of where we're going. Genesis chapter 12, it says, "Now the Lord said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed." That's you, that's me. So to not study Exodus is to leave the story of Genesis incomplete, right? You agree with me? Because God hasn't blessed very many people, and the blessing is pretty shadowy at best when you leave the end of Genesis. You got a few people that are destitute in Egypt. Not a very blessed family. But you see, my God is a promise-keeping God. That's what the story of Exodus is all about. Now, at some point, as we read through this, okay, that's the introduction to the family, that's the introduction to where we're going. Let's actually get to looking at the story of Exodus 1. Sometime along the way, there was a regime change, and there was a new Pharaoh came to the throne who didn't know Joseph. That's what it says. Let's see, that was verse 8. Now, scholars are going to disagree, they're going to argue about whether this was the beginning or whether this is the end of the Hyksos dynasty in Egypt. I'm not going to go there. I got my personal beliefs. If you want to ask me about them, I'll tell you. I'm not going to go into that right now. I can't settle it this morning. Better scholars than me have argued over it for hundreds of years. Let's just take, for this passage through Exodus, let's just take the Bible as it reads and just understand that there's a new Pharaoh in town. All right? The old Pharaoh died, there's a new Pharaoh in town. Who it was, I don't care. The Bible doesn't record it. I'm going to make a point on that in a bit. Now, Jacob's family had settled in the northeast portion of Egypt, up in the Nile Delta, just this side of the Sinai Peninsula, right about where the Suez Canal is today. All right, the tail end, Genesis chapter 47, actually, let's back up a couple of chapters. Back to Genesis 47, verse 1, it tells exactly where. "Joseph came and told Pharaoh and said, my father and my brethren and their flocks and their herds and all that they have are come out of the land of Canaan. And behold, they are in the land of Goshen." That's where they're living, is the land of Goshen, that northeast portion of Egypt, kind of the frontier of the Egyptian Empire. Now this new Pharaoh expresses his concern in verse 10, back in Exodus chapter 1, verse 10. He's got a concern. He says, "Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land." He's afraid that the Israelites might join with their enemies. Which makes sense. We've already mentioned that this new Pharaoh doesn't recognize Israel. The Israelites might as well side with somebody who recognizes them, what they've done, and the benefit that they've done to the land of Egypt. Remember, the land of Egypt would have died in a famine if it weren't for Joseph. Apparently, he's also afraid that they might leave entirely. Well, what's the you're concerned about this great people, that they outnumber you and that they're more mighty than you. What's the problem if they leave? Well, if they leave, they're leaving that northeast frontier totally abandoned, open for attack, right? strategically, that's a bad idea. So with these two fears in mind, this new Pharaoh needs to come up with a new plan. How are we going to deal with this? Well, the plan that he came up with was simple enough. They're, well, hey, let's enslave them. I don't know how you do that. I really don't know how he did that. It doesn't really matter. Obviously, they did. I mean, how do you just tell a group of people that, hey, you know you've been living here for hundreds of years. I'm just going to make you slaves now. I don't know how he executed this plan. Anyway, he did it. But you see, the goal was not just to break their potential military might, but it says he afflicted them with their burdens. Afflicted them with their burdens, that's verse 11. That literally means to crush their spirit. He doesn't just want to remove their potential military power. He wants to crush their spirit. That word translated afflict, I'm going to do a little Hebrew study. I told you that was one of the things I wanted to do. That word afflict is the Hebrew word anah. It means to humble or to put down, to crush. God had exalted this people, you see, and they'd multiplied and grew. It says, well, the Egyptians are about to try and reverse that. Apparently, they assumed that if they enslaved them, they would lose the will to resist. So they're going to give that a try. Now, we'll see as we go along that this is only the first step in a plan to limit the population explosion that had been going on with the Hebrews. The next step is going to be to command the Hebrew midwives to commit infanticide, killing all the male babies and sparing the females, but I don't want to jump the gun and move into that just yet. This is just phase one. Phase one, we're going to make slaves out of them. Now, the Egyptians pretty quickly realized that their plans weren't really going to overthrow the plans of God. God had been multiplying, blessing them, and they were growing. They tried to make slaves out of them. God counteracts the Egyptian plans and blesses the Hebrews in spite of the oppression. The Egyptians were oppressing them. God blesses them anyway. Now there's more and more of them. So the Egyptians were grieved, it says, verse 12. So verses 13 and 14, we see the same phrase show up twice. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage and mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service, wherein they made them serve, was with rigor. Rigorously, they're making them work. The Israelites were forced to work on building projects while also working in the fields to provide their own food. You see that in verse 14? They're working in the fields. They're working with brick. They're working with mortar. They got to do every step of the way. Just to survive, they have to raise their own crops. They've also got to build these things for Pharaoh. Now, this was a time, let's get a historical perspective here. This was a time of Egyptian empire expansion. The empire was expanding up into Canaan. They were starting to push into the Canaanite boundaries. They were also pushing down the Nile River. Remember, the Nile River is one of those few rivers, that and the Contacook, that flow north. There aren't many rivers that do that in the world. The Nile flows north. So they pushed down, upstream, down south into Ethiopia and Somalia and those areas. Now, the Egyptians of those days were some of the best builders in the world. We still see some of the things that they've built. Each pharaoh tried to outdo the one before him, building temples, building palaces, building military garrisons, store cities. Now, all of this building required a huge labor force. Now, the creation of a slave class answers two issues. One, hopefully, will control the growing Hebrew population. And secondly, it should provide that huge labor force that you need. You're building monumental things, you need a lot of people to work on it. During this time, the cities of Pithom and Ramses were built, according to verse 11. These cities were supply stations. It says treasure cities. They were like military garrisons for the, remember I said they were trying to branch off into the Canaanite region? These were supply cities for that. They kept the military stores at Pithom and Ramses for the attack into Canaan. Now, I hope you've seen a theme. It's a very clear theme. I can't imagine that you missed it. There's a theme in Exodus chapter 1 on population growth, right? And childbearing and fertility, right? Very much the theme in this chapter. They're kind of a foreign concept to today's mindset. But again, working on a historical background here, in those days with warfare, with natural disasters, with disease, with infant mortality, things like that, it was a very real possibility for an entire nation to be wiped out all of a sudden. It could happen. In my own mind, I immediately go to the Aztec Empire. You know, that was another huge empire in Central America. They built huge pyramids. They built monumental things. They had a fantastic empire. Today, there are no Aztecs. They were wiped out. Yes, there was warfare. Yes, there was disease. The whole nation is wiped out without a trace. Well, the same thing was entirely possible in these days, too. So population and fertility and things like that were very important to people in those days. This is why so many pagan religions had such a focus on fertility. They had gods of fertility. We're going to talk a little bit about that at the tail end of today. Hang on to the concept. Also, as a sidebar, this is also one of the things that makes God's promises to Abraham so special. God's promises to Abraham. God promised to Abraham that his family would never be wiped out. No matter what happens, Abraham, you and your family are going to go on, and I'm going to bless all the world forever with your family, Abraham. In this day, that means a huge... They're going to be like the sand on the seashore. You can't get rid of it. You can't shovel the sand away fast enough, Abraham. It just keeps coming. That's how your family is going to be. Now, jumping off that concept, that's also the significance of the first three matriarchs of Israel being barren. Remember, Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel were all barren. The significance of that is God was going to be the only one through whom the promise was going to come. No matter how hard you try, no matter how hard you fight, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, your prosperity, your fertility is going to come through me, God said. Not any human agency. See, God was making the point that fertility was not the realm of any fertility god except himself. Even when the Egyptians tried to cut him down, God multiplied him. The Egyptians do their first step in their three-phase plan to eliminate the Hebrews. We're going to enslave them. And God blessed them and they multiplied. Now that kind of put Pharaoh over a barrel. First step in his plan doesn't work very good. Now, think of yourself as Pharaoh. You got a couple of possibilities. You got this burgeoning Hebrew population. How about I just march my army in? It's the most powerful army in the world. I'm the most powerful man on earth. Why don't I just march my army in and slaughter them? Every mother's son of them. Wipe them right out. Scrub the place clean. You got a problem. Now you're going to lose your slave force. Who's going to build my temple? Who's going to build my pyramid? So he enacts a policy of controlled infanticide. Makes more sense than trying to wipe out every mother's son of them. All right, we're going to wipe out some of the kids. We're going to have controlled infanticide. Now, at this point in the story, we're introduced to a couple of very interesting women, Shifra and Pua. They were probably leaders of a midwives organization, a midwives guild, if you want to say so. And they refused to commit this infanticide. They just refused to do it. You see, verse 17 gives you the reason why. But the midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. Verse 21 says something else very interesting. It says, and it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. Now, the King James isn't particularly clear there. It actually meant that he provided a place for them. God provided a place for them. As I read that in the Hebrew phraseology, it tells me that they were probably, these midwives were probably Egyptians who worshiped the Hebrew God. They had come to faith in the Hebrew God. And they were accepted now. When God makes places for them, he accepted them now into the Hebrew community, don't you see? That's the way I read it. You don't get it so much in English. But let's just take it as read. Let's look at this infanticide plan. All right? We've already expressed the problem. You don't want to just kill them all off because then you lose your slave population. So why kill the males? Aren't they a stronger workforce? Why would you kill the male? Why not kill the females? Save the males alive. You'd have a better workforce, right? Stronger. What's that? Yeah, Jewish males do tend to grow up to be lawyers or bankers. I shouldn't have said that. That wasn't right. I apologize. That was outright racism. let me propose this to you. If you keep the girls alive, who are apparently blessed with fertility, you've already seen that, you can marry them off into other slave groups and still maintain a large slave population, right? Makes sense. The ironic thing in my mind is that by enacting a plan to kill the Hebrew children, Pharaoh was actually unknowingly setting the ball rolling on wiping out the Egyptian firstborn later. Do you see how God turned that very act upon him? We're going to see it later on as we go. You know the story. You've seen Ten Commandments. I even watched that movie in research for this. you see, this open challenge to God's power and authority is starting to come to a head. This is a direct challenge to God's power and God's authority. God had promised that Abraham would have a large family and that they would live in the land of Canaan. Well, so far, there's a large family, but they're not in Canaan. The most powerful man on earth is actively trying to destroy them. What are you going to do, God? What are you going to do? They've got a large family, but they're not in Canaan, and they're being held hostage by the most powerful man on earth. God's going to have to deliver them, isn't he? God's going to have to deliver them if he's going to keep his promises. And do you know my God always keeps his promises? Every single time. So what's it going to take to get this deliverance started? We agree God's going to have to deliver them. What's it going to take to get this deliverance started? What's going to break the will of the mightiest man on earth at the time? Just a couple of God-fearing midwives, that's all. Just a couple of God-fearing midwives. Do you see the contrast here? There's a very sharp contrast going on here. Pharaoh is powerful. They aren't. He is a male. This is a very male-centered universe at this time. They are female. He has influence. If anyone on earth has influence, he has influence. They don't have any influence. He could kill them easily. But they stood up to him. But look again. Look again here. We don't even know who this Pharaoh is. But we know who Shifra and Pua are for all eternity. We know that their names were Shifra and Pua, and they will stand in God's word forever. We don't even know who the Pharaoh was. What a contrast there, isn't it? You see, God rewards the obedient, doesn't he? God rewards the obedient. They feared God, and their names are recorded forever. Pharaoh stood in opposition to God, and we don't even know who he was. These women were more concerned with offending God than with offending Pharaoh. Let's see what Jesus had to say about it. This is the words in red. We've got to pay attention to them. Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10, verse 28. Jesus said, "And fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." Well, that puts a different perspective on it, doesn't it? And you know, to fear God is to obey him. And these women knew that. So we're wrapping up here. Well, when Pharaoh found out that he couldn't rely on these midwives, he then turns to all the people. You see that, verse 22? It says, and Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. So he turns to the Egyptian populace and says, drown any Hebrew boy that you can find. He's trying to use the Nile to destroy the Hebrews. And that's going to fail as well. Now, by the way, the Egyptians worshipped the Nile as a god. You know what god the Nile was? His name was Hapi, H-A-P-I, and he was their fertility god. Do you see an ironic twist here? By the way, throughout the book of Exodus, we're going to see God attack every single one of the major Egyptian deities. Every single one. Well, they worship this fertility god, and they're going to use this fertility god to destroy this Hebrew god. That's what's going on here. That's the significance of drowning them, not slicing their throats or anything else. He is going to drown them in the fertility god. We're going to see in the next chapter that God uses that very Nile, that very fertility god, to deliver his servant, the deliverer of the nation of Israel, is going to come floating down in a raft on that Nile River, the very tool that they were supposed to use to kill him. Do you see the irony going on here? My God is more powerful than any god. My God will keep his promises no matter what. So we've set the stage. Do you see the need for the deliverance of the Hebrews? They're being held hostage by the most powerful man on earth. There's an active attempt at destroying them. And my God's name is on the line. He's made promises hundreds of years before, and he's got to make good on those promises. You know, my God works really well when he's backed into a corner. If God's going to bless these folks like he's promised to, he's got to get them out of Egypt. And this is just going to be one more chance for my God to show himself to be mighty. And he still is today. That's what the book of Exodus is about. And that's where we're going to go. I hope you're excited. I am. If you don't see that. Derek, could I have you close us in a word of prayer this morning?
Sure.
Thank you.